Donahue. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5.
Some bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory? If you meet the Undertaker, or the young man from the crew, have a pint with what's left over. Now I'll say goodbye to you. For the bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
And Malachi, are you there, the one and only?
I am here, John. Are you all there?
Yes, Malachi, 50 days left. If you're tired of winning, you know how to vote. But if you're not tired of winning, you know who to vote for. He said that he would be winning so much that we'll be tired of winning. And I think we're kind of tired of winning at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I am of an age, John, when I get tired anyway. And one of them is tired of hearing the rubbish that emanates from the shite house at the the White House.
Yes.
At the moment. So here we go, John.
Well, Malachi, we're going to talk a little bit about 9/11, which was on Friday, and we'll talk about what happened to both of us, particularly what happened to you. But our special guest today is going to be Laura Gwen Shapiro, and she has a story in The New Yorker, which Malachi McCourt is in, because how is it you're going to do a story about Dorothy Parker? You have to have Malachi in it. And Malachi will be telling us the story and about Lori. And a little bird told me, Malachi, people were praying that you would not mention about the story being researched and done and about the ashes. And you were able to keep it off Facebook, BAI, Instagram, so you were able to.
Yeah, because there was almost scooped by somebody else, but Laurie kept it all very quiet, and there was a bunch of us kept it quiet too. And it was rushed into print at the New Yorker. So there it was last week ago, Friday, I think it was.
Yeah, and then in the first half hour, we're going to have on Maria Deasy, the president of the Irish American Writers and Artists. And at 2:00 today, if she'll give you the details how to see, there's going to be a transatlantic salon with artists and writers on both sides of the Atlantic doing a Zoom salon. So that should be really interesting today at 2:00. It'll be 7:00 over there. And then we're hoping, after the interview with Laura, that we'll be taking phone calls from WBAI. And we want to do this from now and up to the election. And we want to talk about the election, maybe the interview that was done. And we want to keep any BAI person, please, if we're going to talk about 9/11. I don't want to hear about Building 7, the inside job, maybe a personal experience and Tony Tales. I know you're listening. You've been tweeting all week about the show. One topic when you get in. And then get out. And two announcements that I want to make is that Malachi and myself are going to start a podcast. We're a little bit late to the game because people like David Rothenberg on the Fortune Society has a podcast, and Gary Knoll and Amy Goodman, and it seems everybody has a podcast. But now we're going to have two Macs
and
a
Michael
pod.
Moore.
We're going to start it on Wednesday. We don't know how it'll go, what platform it's going to be up on. But if you go to Malachi's Facebook on Malachi McCourt or my Twitter or Facebook, you'll find the links. We're just starting out, so we'll have more details next week at Cabtivist, CABTIVIST. And we're hoping to have it on SoundCloud, Spotify, and everything else. And there'll be just longer versions of a lot of the interviews that we do on WBAI. And speaking of BAI and fundraising, David Rothenberg, before the pandemic, had set up almost on a monthly basis Conversations with Malachi McCord and David Rothenberg, with myself as the MC. We did it downstairs at the Brooklyn Cafe. We did it at the Fortune Society, the Castle up in 140th Street. Well, we're going to do a Zoom fundraiser called an election special fundraiser, hopefully on Sunday, October 11th. And this will be after the first presidential debate of September 29th and the vice presidential debate of October 7th. So they'll be able to comment on that. And what we're going to have set up is on the WBAI website. You go, you make a $20 donation. And on the day of the election special, that Sunday, an email will go out to you about where you can watch the first of all, it won't be a debate. It's David Rothenberg and Malachi McCord. They're probably going to try to outlift each other. Well, I'll be throwing you the red meat, but it's not as if the two of you are going to be debating.
I'm sorry, John. I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be who's further to the left of Marx, David Rothenberg or Malachi McCord on the election. So we had a lot of fun doing it downstairs at 388 and up at the Castle. So, Malachi, those are the two things. And normally we would have on the Cuba Boys, who two firemen that retired that tortured BAI for years, but they were down there at 9/11. But on that date, your name popped up that there was McCourt's killed that day, and a lot of people thought it was you and Diana. So yes. Maybe you could just tell us that story.
Well, we were traveling though. We were in, we had taken a holiday, and somewhere we'd always wanted to go. We went to Newfoundland, and so we traveled, we motored across, and then we got back to St. John, and we took a plane from there to Halifax in Nova Scotia on the 10th of September. And we were supposed to leave Halifax on 2 o'clock on the 10th of September. So we got on the plane, and it was destined for Newark Airport. So we were about half an hour out when the pilot got on and said that there was a fire at Newark Airport, so we were not able to land. So he made a U-turn, and we went right back to Halifax, landed at about 3:30 now. So we waited and waited and waited, and then about 5 o'clock, they said, we're ready to go. So off we trundled back onto the plane. We taxied out to the end of the runway, and you know how they... And then the pilot gets on and says, ladies and gentlemen, regret to tell you, but now there is a flood at Newark. So we can't land there, so we have to go back to the airport, back to the our starting point. So another U-turn back, and then we waited until about 7. Diana and I tried to get a connection from there to Boston and then take a Boston plane back to New York, but we couldn't do that. So anyway, we waited and waited, and finally at 7 o'clock, they said, we can't take off at all tonight, so we will do it in the morning. We checked into a motel and slept, got out to the airport, and got on the plane at about 7 a.m., and off we took. So we got into Newark. And as we were, we could see the World Trade Center, and there was, we didn't know, there was some sort of smoky thing over there. And Diana said, does it always pollute like that? But the customs lady there said, oh, no. She said, there's a small plane has just hit the World Trade Center, a small plane. So that was, so we're looking, and then we were in waiting for our baggage, and you could see the two buildings from there, and Diana had the pictures, and then somebody said, Jesus Christ, there goes another one. And we could see the other little planes crashing in. And that was number two. So there we were, stuck out there. And the airport cleared. And we got our luggage and went outside. And I had to go miles. A mile away was the long-term parking. We had a rented car there. So we, I got out there, but I was being stopped because now the military had taken over the airport. So finally I got back, and there was Diana all alone with this little pile of luggage, and we got in. Now, we couldn't, we couldn't get in to New York because everything was it was all closed off. But I had someone. I had a what appeared to be a New York senior officer shirt on, and I had a piece of police ID, and I just waved that, and that. So after 7 hours, we got into Manhattan. So we got into our building, and the doorman staggered. Back, he, oh my God, he said, what are you? And what happened was that there were two people named McCourt on the second plane that hit, and that passenger list had gone out without naming the gender of the two people, and it was a woman and her daughter, Ruth, and Juliana Valentine McCourt, a little girl, four, and her mom, who was from Cork. So that was the day that we had. And then, as everybody knows, we all had the experience. But everybody thought we were dead. And that was all because we were in the air. Just as a matter of fact, we just landed a few minutes after the first hit. And we were the last plane in from Air Canada. So that was our experience on 9/11, and it looked like we had died. That was, and everybody has a story to tell there. And then I contacted the father and the husband of the two folks. His name was David McCourt. And he said, oh, I know who you are, he said. I always listen to you when you're on WMCA. And he said, you always made me laugh. And this note says, thank you for the call and your sincere condolences. It helps me in my pain, David McCourt. And that was on a little press issue here. Foundation established in memory of Juliana Valentine McCourt. And in order to transform the devastation of September 11th into a constructive effort, the Loving family, in its inexpressible grief, has established a foundation in her memory to foster harmony, peace, and understanding among the children of the world. So there is that foundation in her memory. And then, of course, we all have friends. A guy that I was very good friends with happened to be the first casualty of the World Trade Center. That was Mike Judge, Father Michael Judge. Now, I'm not usually in close contact with clergy, but Mike was one of the best and most amazing people in the whole world. And he was hit by something or other. He was a chaplain to the fire department, a great man, a lovely man. So that was so there were my two connections, the McCourt and Michael Judge, and we all had friends, many, except Trump said he had many friends, but he was asked to name one, he couldn't, but he did managed to get paid for damage to a building that he was nowhere near the World Trade Center, but he got compensation for a building that was so far away. But anyway, good luck to him. So anyway, John, that is my story of that fateful day. And to have been in the air that close and all of that makes it absolutely unforgettable. And there are two other days, other 9/11s, that are fateful. One was Allende being overthrown by Kissinger and Pablo Neruda, the great Chilean poet, was poisoned by them, by this our crowd here. And then that great conservative Christian, Oliver Cromwell, 9/11, 1649, he killed, oddly enough, 3,000 people at the siege of Drogheda. And he said he did it in the name of Jesus and for God. And he said that it was such a work. It was such a it was such, doing God's work like that, and the British Parliament, now Cromwell said that it has pleased God to bless our endeavor at Drogheda. The enemy was about 3,000 strong in the town. I believe we put to the sword the whole number. This hath been a marvelous great mercy. I wish that all honest hearts may give the glory of this to God alone, to whom indeed the praise of this mercy belongs. In this place, St. Peter's Church, 1,000 of them were put to the sword, fleeing for safety. I now give me leave to say how this work was wrought. It was set upon some of our hearts that a great thing should be done, not by power or might, but by the Spirit of God. And is not so clearly. October 2nd, 1649, the English Parliament, Conservative Parliament, appointed a National Thanksgiving Day in celebration of the killing of the 3,000 in Drogheda. That the House doth approve of the execution done at Drogheda as an act of both justice to them and mercy to others who may be warned by it. They also said that when a bunch of them, they were caught later on, of the Irish, when they stripped them to hang them, they found that these 1,000 Irish men had tails a half a yard long. Did you know that, John, that the Irish had tails?
No, I'm just looking up what you're talking about. The 1649 massacre about that in Drogheda. And it actually says it's war crimes that would happen there. But, you know, it's war crimes and you're suffering it. But if you're inflicting it, you get a holiday over in England.
It was God. It was an act of power. And a day of Thanksgiving was declared. It was like what they said here, which with the lies they said that all these Arabs were dancing in the streets with joy all over the world at the bombing of the World Center, and that the Irish, of course, were always celebrating the defeats of the Brits, and that Ireland belonged to England. But anyway, now Trump is the first man of his family to be born without a tail. But have you got a tail, John?
I'll have to check, Malky.
Yeah, I tell tales, but I don't have one.
Yes.
I think,
Malky, it's an unfortunate segue, but we're going to talk about transatlantic tales that will be told today at 2 o'clock. The Irish-American writers and artists are doing an international transatlantic salon because of Zoom and all the new technology. And with us on the line is Maria Deasy, the president of the Irish American Writers and Artists. And Malachi, she's on.
Oh, hello.
Maria there.
I am here. I actually have a tale. little known fact. I'm just kidding. No, we will be telling tales, something that you, Maliki, are very adept at as the one of the founders of Irish American Writers and Artists. And as John said, I'm the current president and will be presiding over a transatlantic salon, which is going to be amazing. It's today at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, U.S. EST, and 7 p.m. Ireland Time. And we're going to have a full roster of presenters that are poets, Bowron players, concert pianists, storytellers, Galway Hooker Festival presidents, lots and lots of folks reading from their novels, you know, as I said, poetry and all the wonderful arts that we celebrate in Ireland. We have people in Ireland coming from Kerry and from the East Wall of Dublin and from the great county of Mayo. And
God help us.
And then on our end, we have the wonderful Honor Malloy, who will be reading from her latest play. And
what a Welsh writer she is.
Yes. And
one of the best. Maria, absolutely. What from what time again?
So it's going to be New York time, Eastern Standard Time, 2 p.m.
2 p.m., okay. An hour after we are now. And then what was the approximate length of the presentation?
I think it's going to go, including a break, about 2 hours 15 maybe. And then we're going to have some time for chat at the end. People can hang on the Zoom for however long they want to be. And people
and
can find
us. Are the presentations limited to 10 minutes?
They're officially limited to about 5 to 8. They'll be under 8 minutes actually each one.
Right. And how many artists then will you present today?
My goodness. So we have, the reason it's like a trickier answer is that the first half we have 5 artists.
Yeah.
And then the second half, we have the poet Paula Meehan, which is really exciting. And following her, we're going to have a group of women who collectively call themselves Banshee, but who individually are journalists and poets and dancers and theater producers. And each one of them is going to do a few minutes of their own work. And then they, you know, will probably do some banter and talk about their group. They were originally started in New York and they've kind of some of them are in New York and some are back in Ireland. And so they're reuniting for the first time in some years.
And the Banshee is a traditional, it is a mystical female who appears when somebody of a prominent family is about to die, and somewhere off in the wilderness there is a loud grieving wailing, and that's the coming of the Banshee. Foretells death. The literal translation of Banshee is born she. It is white woman. That is it. Why that is, I don't know, but there we are. But it's always it's said in a pejorative kind of way, as if a banshee is a nagger or something like that. But anyway, I just thought I'd throw that in.
No, that's very, very interesting. And true. I think if you grew up in an Irish family, you certainly know that, you know, the tradition of the banshee wailing. But I think
if you're a very prominent family.
I didn't know it was a prominent family, actually.
Well, they were supposed to be. We were slum dwellers, so we didn't have our own banshee.
You didn't have your own banshee.
we were too poor to afford the banshee.
<That's
terrible. laughs> She takes a lot of money.
She does. Well, you know, maybe we can get her cheap these days, or she'll be on Zoom in any case. But you know, I think that these women have turned the concept on its head, you know, and basically taken the term back for themselves with pride to denote women expressing themselves artistically and, you know, with strong opinions and strong self-expression.
Are
they? So I think that they've, we're hopefully they're going to talk a bit about the origin of that, why they name themselves the Banshee as a collective.
That's very daring, actually.
I love it. I think it's a really cool thing to call a women's collective.
Well, death always is. So cool. Cold. Cold.
And Maria, how can people see this today? And is it free?
Sure. So it is free, absolutely, because we have a lot of money in our – no, just kidding. We do all of our salons for free. That's part of our mission, you know, is to share artistry and to collaborate and, meet together. So we'll be meeting together on Zoom. You can, if you'd like to come onto the Zoom, the link, just email iasalon@hotmail.com. That's iasalon@hotmail.com. Or you can just go to our Facebook page, Irish American Writers and Artists, and click on the live stream. It'll be, I think, as part of the event. You might have to look onto the event itself, or it might just be right there on our Facebook page, but you'll be able to find it pretty easily streaming live as well. But if
Maria,
you kind of want to be
this might be
in the
also
room,
a good time to tell people that our organization was founded to put to rest the idea that all Irish are right-wing, bigoted, racist, white supremacists. We are an organization that you do not have to be Irish. You do not have to be American. And you can join up with us. And if you have an inclination to write, paint, sing, we might even have dancers. For whatever your
art is,
you get a chance to exercise it with us. And we're not there to criticize. We are there to help each other and to spread peace, humanity, decency, and above all, love of each other and of the great things that happen in this great country. And we were there because of there was a tendency to think that we Irish were bigoted and towards folks of other nationalities and ethnic groups. So we're not. Some of us are not. There are some.
There's
a group of conservative yahoos at the moment that are surrounding the current 4F, former president. They are any Irish person that is a conservative is a disgrace to humanity. But anyway, that's another thing. So we are.
If you want
to join our organization, go and follow the directions that Maria just gave.
Right. Yeah. So very well said, Maliki. I could not have said that better myself. We are bipartisan at the same time, but we certainly stand for those values above and beyond any values. So absolutely well said. We are here to support, love each other, and we are all inclusive. We're not exclusive at all. We include everyone of any ethnicity, race, creed, none at all, no creed at all.
And
but
also,
anyway,
you don't have to be Catholic.
Right.
You can be an atheist, Jewish,
no,
Muslim, anything you want to be.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But put your clothes on before you come to our gatherings.
You do have to follow the general laws of decency.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maliki, we're going to move on now to the main topic of the day. The Algonquin Roundtable. And Maria, thanks for coming on. And everyone, 2 o'clock today, just type in Irish American Writers and Artists, and it'll pop up for the Facebook or the website, or go to iasalon@hotmail.com, and you can join.
Email
that. Right. Yeah. So, Maliki,
thanks, Maria. All the best.
You're welcome. See you later. See you on the Zoom. Bye-bye.
There's a great story in the New Yorker, and you've told stories about Dorothy Parker and the infamous Algonquin round table over there on 44th Street there, just off Times Square. And there's a story in the New Yorker that it's bouncing all over the net internet, written by Laura Gwen Shapiro. And what we're going to do now is play a poem from Dorothy Parker. Maybe we'll come out and tell exactly who Dorothy Parker was. But Malachi, when I saw this quote, I said, this could have been a Malachi McCourt quote. Now, this is to Dorothy Parker. It says here, the first thing I do in the morning is brush my teeth and sharpen my tongue. And I said, you know what? That's something Malachi McCourt would say. And then Malachi...
Well, so I did say something like that at the airport out in California when they were, have you packed your own bag and so forth? And the security woman said to me, are you carrying anything sharp? And I said, nothing but my tongue. So she immediately summoned two National Guard guys, fully armed, and put them on either side of me. And then she went through me, all my body, with this beep, 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 beep thing up and down, in and out, under my armpit. And then she comes around to the front and she says, open your mouth. I said, what? She said, open your mouth. I said, okay, open my mouth. She said, lift your tongue. She thought I had something in my tongue because I said it was sharp, you know. So I said, you must be joking. She said, we don't joke here. Lift your tongue.
So that's why I love that quote.
So anyway, all right, Oscar Wilde said that. Yeah.
And when we come back, we'll be speaking with your friend from The New Yorker, Lori. Right now, a poem, not read by Dorothy, but when we come out of that, we'll be speaking with Lori.
Oh, I can smile for you and tilt my head and drink your rushing words with eager lips and paint my mouth for you a fragrant red and trace your brows with tutored fingertips. When you rehearse your lists of loves to me, oh, I can laugh and marvel rapturous-eyed, and you laugh back, nor can you ever see the thousand little deaths my heart has died. And you believe so well I know my part, that I am gay as morning, light as snow, and all the straining things within my heart you'll never know. Oh, I can laugh and listen when we meet, and you bring tales of fresh adventurings, of ladies delicately indiscreet, of lingering hands and gently whispered things. And you are pleased with me, and strive anew to sing me sagas of your late delights. Thus do you want me, marvelling gay and true, nor do you see my staring eyes of nights. And when, in search of novelty, you stray, oh, I can kiss you blithely as you go. And what goes on, my love, while you're away, you'll never know.
EAI here in New York City, and that was a poem by Dorothy Parker. And there's a story in The New Yorker right now, and it tells this unbelievable tale how the ashes of Dorothy Parker have been traveling around the East Coast and finally made it back to the family plot up at Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. And Malachi, maybe you can do your 20-minute introduction to your friend Lori now. And I'm going to, just like Judy Collins, I'm going to sit back and listen to the two of you schmooze.
Okay,
I'm
John.
For this thank too. You.
Well, the thing is, among other things, I've known Lori, you know, for a number of years, and she's a good friend. And also, when Connor, my son Connor, made the McCourts of New York and two films, and Lori was a producer. And we happened to go back to India to the scene where I used to be a gold smuggler. And we went next to a crematorium, speaking, we can't get away from ashes. And we got in trouble because we put the camera on a dead body and they got upset. But anyway, Lori is the many things that she's so accomplished. She's a filmmaker. She's a marvelous storyteller, a terrific writer, and it goes on. And she's been involved with radio and television, public relations, and just about anything that's, it's, she's a real New Yorker in that sense. She does everything, and she has a great brain. Laurie Shapiro, there you are.
Oh, thank you, Maliki. I'm so excited to be talking to you on a Sunday morning. And I'm so excited that your Dorothy Parker story has gone into the New Yorker where it belongs.
So what, now, of course, Dorothy Parker, she was so known to her for her. What was it she said about Hepburn? She said something in a critique of Hepburn.
You know what? I'm gonna hope. I don't have that quote at my fingertips, but the
was
person
something
that
about her talents range from A to B was something like that.
Yeah, and I know the one you're talking about, but the person that the story is partially about that ran in the New Yorker was about a tour guide named Kevin Fitzpatrick, who is determined to get her ashes back to New York City. And he's Encyclopedia Brown of Dorothy. I could, you know, too bad I can't text him while I'm on the air and he'll come back in 3 seconds. But I will say that this story is one that really makes me happy as a New Yorker. And I know for your radio listeners, if I can give a little background, is that Dorothy Parker, and this is very fitting for this show, was very active with the civil rights going all the way back to the 1920s. And that's part of the story. And you come into the story, I wrote this like very chronologically. I was almost thinking, how would Maliki McCourt tell this story? Like at a bar, telling you can't believe the story, and this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. But we start back in the 20s when she was one of the first, she was the first Broadway female critic, and she would call out racism. When no one else was doing that, she would talk about the blackface race of certain playwrights. She was very active all through the 30s. She was active in the McCarthy era. And what happens in this story is that in the 1960s, before she passes away, you meet her. So let's come in with that. What happens when you met her? Where were you? I think it was 1961 precisely when you met her.
Yes. I was out in California, and I was looking for stardom, and it was eluding me.
I remember you mentioned George Stevens to me.
I met George Stevens, yes. Jr. His father was a great movie director. He was a great director of epics. And George was head of the American Film Institute and also a director himself. But anyway, he had a cocktail party. Not a party, at a party anyway. So I went to this party. I think it was in Bel Air or Beverly Hills. I don't know. It was a very fancy joint anyway. So anyway, I was not.
You were an actor at that point.
I was trying to be, yeah. And but I was not having very much luck. I did a couple of things, but there we were. But anyway, so there was a woman, a smallish woman, somewhat on the elderly side, sitting by herself with a beverage, and I went over and I sat down beside her. And I said, my name is Maliki. And she said, my name is Dorothy. And she said, what are you doing? And we chatted about this, that, and the other thing. So then I said to her, could I take you home tonight? And she looked at me with this kind of a patronizing look. And she said, young man, if you think you're flattering me, you're not. Now, she said, go and get someone your own age. Oh, no,
how
no,
old
no.
Were
I
you?
Said,
30?
I wouldn't bother talk to you.
Are you 30? In 1961, you're 30?
Yes, yes.
So this is, she's already elderly.
60-ish, I think.
She's pretty cheeky.
Yes, around that,
I
think.
Pretty cheeky,
yeah.
Maliki.
But she was very, very, I must say, she was very kind to me, and but she was pretty quick, though, young man, if you think you're flattering me. She wasn't buying it.
Well, so that was my introduction to Dorothy Parker.
And that was the first time you met her, right?
What's that? And then my
that
next...
That was the first time.
That's
that you
the
met
first
her.
Time. So my second meeting with her was in, I forget now what the year this was, but I had a lunch date with Paul O'Dwyer, who was city council president, but he wasn't 80. At that time.
I, according to my notes, which everything has to be trimmed, but this was in the early 80s.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So anyway, I don't know how it came up. Well, he was doing a few things before we went out to lunch. He said, meet him at his office. So we did. And I went to chat. I don't know, something about Dorothy Parker. And I said, I met her once. And he said, would you like to meet her again? So I said, well, she's dead, isn't she? So he said, well, so he went to his one of those bureaus and pulled open a drawer and took out an urn and said, these are her ashes. I don't know why I got them, but I'm supposed to do something with them. So you have the rest of that story, Laurie Shapiro.
Yes, but I had heard that you had, I mean, I actually think you even mentioned it a tiny bit in Among Swimming, if I'm not crazy. But I always held on to this story. And when this story started to develop, I always thought, I got to get Maliki's story back into the greater story.
Yes,
but
yeah, it sure
I will
is.
Tell you
yeah.
that I
I've
met.
I've had more comment, uh-huh. I must say. There is, I mean, just about every, I don't know. So many people must read The New Yorker, but there is. I mean, I have had so many, I can't tell you how many people have talked to me about it, because everybody just says what a marvelous story it is and how well told. So
well,
there we are.
It is a crazy story. It is a great, but it's a great New York story. And what's so great about it is that the quintessential New Yorker is back in New York. And in the Bronx, as in the great cemetery of Woodlawn, where so many jazz greats are buried, and Herman Melville is buried, you just have, you know, so many legends there. And she's back with many also of her peers from the 20s and the 30s are there. But to go back to a little bit of the story, what happened is because of her civil rights activism, she ended up, of all places, buried near a parking lot in Baltimore after her ashes were found. And I'm going to go back in time to the story. So now you're with Paul O'Dwyer, who, as many people on this show probably know, was the brother of Mike O'Dwyer, one of the mayors of New York.
No, that was Bill.
Oh, sorry, did I say Mike? I meant Bill O'Dwyer.
Bill O'Dwyer,
Before my time, so I'm glad I have you to correct me. But he was the brother of the, and he was very active as a person. I know he was a good friend of yours. He was also born in Ireland and came to New York, from what I remember. But what happened was that the original lawyer for Dorothy Parker was a man named Oscar Bernstein.
Yes.
And as Maliki pointed out to me when I was writing down this story, that it's not spelled S-T-E-I-N, it's S-T-I-E-N, which didn't quite get past the fact checkers of The New Yorker, but I said, I swear this is true.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
Bernstein
it is.
Spelled that way. And but he was elderly, and he retired around 1972. But when Dorothy Parker passed away, she had named Lillian Hellman as her executor.
Executor, yeah.
And I think Lillian Hellman thought she was going to get some money. It wasn't that there was so much money, but definitely the literary estate was valuable. But she had been a friend. But what she did was surprise everybody, because she left her entire estate to Martin Luther King. And Lillian Hellman was quoted as saying that, oh, she must have been drunk. But if you look at her past record of activism, it makes perfect sense. She had no heirs. She had been married twice. Her second husband had passed away
had overdosed actually 2 years prior. And she wanted to do something with her legacy. And she did put a little asterisk saying that if anything happened to Martin Luther King, the estate shall pass to the NAACP. And
yeah.
that is why we get to Baltimore, because when O'Dwyer has it in his desk, it's because Lillian Hellman was so mad she never picked up the ashes. She didn't pay for the storage. And the crematorium, Ferncliff in Hartsdale, said, what the heck is this urn still doing here? And they mailed it to Bernstein and O'Dwyer.
Right, that's right. They were retired. Down there on
down by Wall Street. Near
Pauley Square.
Yeah. And O'Dwyer really hadn't worked with Dorothy Parker. It had been Bernstein had worked with her. So he didn't know what to do with it. And that's why he put it into his desk filing cabinet. And later on, your story got out. I guess you must have been telling it, and other people heard about it. And I think O'Dwyer thought, I got to make sure that something happens with her to protect her. So he calls another famous New Yorker, Liz Smith, who had the gossip columnist, and she puts it out in the paper, and it becomes a big cause for everyone to try to put in their two cents what should happen to Dorothy Parker, and they have a crazy party, which you can read about in the New Yorker. And the thing that happens is that one gentleman, Dr. Benjamin Hooks, from the NAACP says, well, we don't really have rights to her urn. We have her legacy, but we'll take care of Dorothy Parker. And you can imagine the reaction of diehard New Yorkers in the room when he was saying, I'm going to take Dorothy to Baltimore. But
of all places.
Of all places. But, you know, it was a really lovely gesture, if you really think about it. There was nowhere. Yeah. They put in $10,000. They built a small garden near their parking lot in suburban Baltimore that was just by herself.
NAACP.
Yes. And it was a beautiful gesture. But what happened to rush it through is that, you know, over the course of time, people don't know where Dorothy Parker is. They've moved. She's by herself. And in 2006, we get to one of the story's protagonists, Kevin Fitzpatrick, who's the head of the Dorothy Parker Society. And he thinks, you know, that's not a safe place for her urn. You know, we've got to get her back. They're not in the business. NAACP, their job is not to take care of urns. And we got to get it into a safer place. And that's 14 years ago is when the story starts again.
Yeah. So, what spurred your interest, Laurie? This is Laurie Shapiro, and she has this wonderful piece in the New Yorker on the journey of Dorothy Parker's ashes. And again, Dorothy Parker was a famous New Yorker, known for her sharp wit, sharp tongue, and for her great sense of humor. And she was the sort of woman you would not want to make an enemy of, because you'd be overpowered immediately, man or woman that you might be. But anyway, Laurie Shapiro has written the piece that is in the New Yorker. And how did you get to your interest? What spurred it?
Well, I will say that the first, you know, I am a writer as well as a filmmaker, but I, as many people who know my connection to Malachy know, that when my mother was also a great lover of New York and of words, and in fact was friends with you through the films, Connors films.
And had come to the opening, as a matter of fact.
And I was going to say that one of the most moving moments of my life is when you took over an Ashkenazi Jewish funeral service and turned it into an Irish wake. And I've never seen people laugh at a Jewish. I mean, it was the worst day of my life, and I was smiling because of you. You told great stories at my mother's funeral. Even the rabbi just kind of stood back and let you take over. But I will say that my mother.
I'm not even circumcised.
So you still go. And I mean, it was one of, it literally stays in my mind as one of the most tender moments of my life. But anyhow, my mother always loved Dorothy Parker. Was the first poems that I read. I would read her short stories. She also loved Ogden Nash, and that's what I grew up with. And I have always had an interest in The New Yorker and Dorothy Parker. And I took a walking tour 5 years ago on her birthday, which was August 22nd, and I met this gentleman named Kevin Fitzpatrick, who was leading this site tour of, you know, on the Upper West Side of places associated with her. Because she was actually born, she was a native New Yorker with an asterisk. She was actually born on her parents' holiday the last week of August in New Jersey, but she said she missed out on getting that. You know, so by one week, she missed out on being called a native New Yorker because her parents came back to the Upper West Side a week after her birth. But that's how I met Kevin.
You know, Laurie, this is one of my things. All native New Yorkers are from out of town.
Well,
how about that for a contradiction? Dorothy Parker is one of her parents was Jewish, right?
Yes.
Which
well,
one?
Her father was Jewish.
Yes.
And her mother died when she was young, and was not Jewish. I believe she was Scottish, but she was raised by an evil stepmother who was sent her to Catholic school, which she did not like. But
oh my God! Yes.
But she never called herself Jewish. But she identified as a Jew, like culturally Jewish, like sort of like many Jews in New York that are agnostic or atheist, but would never not call themselves Jewish. But there was a Jewish culture about her, and she once made a quip that she's just a. You know, that she was Jewish, but I don't think that people in New York are anything. I think people in New York are all ethnicities, if you know what I mean. Like, yeah. I feel like I'm part Dominican because I eat a lot of Dominican food, too.
My first wife is Jewish. Diana's first husband's Jewish. So our kids are Jewish and so forth.
Right.
So it's perfectly all right with me.
You can also
somebody
call me Laurie
says,
O'Leary.
I don't care what you do so long as you don't frighten the horses. That's the main thing. So your mother's interest in Dorothy Parker got you going on it. So you've read her stuff. Now, how the list of wits and great literary minds and poets and so forth that were at the round table. Was it your opinion that people prepared witticisms for the lunch?
No, I don't think so. I mean, she, by the way, would downplay a lot of the Algonquin roundtable later. But I think that they kind of enjoyed each other's company, but some of them were frenemies. But one thing that I learned from Kevin Fitzpatrick when I was researching this is that the owner of the Algonquin did not have a bar there and was also a family man and didn't want to get shut down. So at the Algonquin Roundtable, these were drinkers, but they were not drinking. There was no speakeasy action going on there. So there's lots of myths. Many, many quotes are given to Dorothy Parker that she did not say. There's many... Instagram memes, sort of like Albert Einstein. Like, we want her to have said everything. But sorting out the truth has been, part of my journey as a journalist. But following, to me, the greatest opportunity came July 2019 when Kevin, who I had become friendly with through that walking tour, and I had actually joined the Dorothy Parker Society, knew how much I loved New York. I mean, I'm a diehard New Yorker myself, born and bred. I love the idea that there would be someone to try to get Dorothy Parker back where I believe she belongs as well. And he let me in on the secret. And that is when we started working on the story, which that's when Kevin had been working with since 2006 with the three grandnieces of Dorothy Parker, are very much alive and lovely women. They live up in central New York, there's three sisters. And they wanted her back. Their family didn't know really what had happened to her. There had been, you know, a family divide at some point over at a funeral, as many people have in our lives, and they made up. But they didn't really know what had become of her. And they were very active working with Kevin to bring her back. And there were lots of paperwork to find out about, and Woodlawn found out that there was a family plot and there was space for her. And this
and
was
so
an incredible
you have
journey.
Put paid to that old saying, that is, you can't go home again. You proved you can.
You can go home if you're Dorothy Parker.
So well.
But I will say that their story started to leak out a little bit again when the NAACP, he is going to be moving to Washington, D.C., but they left their headquarters and moved to a temporary office downtown in Baltimore. And there was no one there except for Dorothy Parker. And people started to wonder what's happening to Dorothy Parker. And meanwhile, we were waiting for the green light to go get her. There was lots, and there's a pandemic happens as well. How are you going to go get Dorothy Parker in a pandemic? And finally, the sisters decided they are, you know, as one sister says, I prefer the word mature, not elderly. they weren't going to get too connected because they obviously have to keep safe. And Kevin and I went down by Amtrak. It was an empty train, and to go get her. And there was a service at the, you know, where they actually had a combination of NAACP executives, and there was the rabbi who had helped bury her with the Kaddish in 1988 down in Baltimore.
Oh.
Came back. And we thought it was going to take 15 minutes to get her out of the ground, but it ended up taking hours, and there were jackhammers coming. I mean, it was quite nerve-wracking to know if we would ever get her out.
Was it concrete over?
All concrete, but nobody really knew. It was a barrel of concrete, and it went on for hours. And
God's sake, yeah.
It was, and I remember, and this is also in the story, that Kevin said, you know, Mrs. Parker has a 2:45 train back to New York. I hope we make it. But we took the train back. With Dorothy Parker, had her own seat.
Yeah. Oh, well done. Well done.
And then we had to, you know, there was a couple of days later, there was a secret ceremony just to get her safely in the ground at Woodlawn. And I know there's going to be, after the pandemic is, you know, past its crisis point, I know that the Dorothy Parker Society and the three sisters, who are very much part of this story, are planning to have a stone unveiling, and they want people to come that are connected to Parker fans and celebrities. They're hoping that you come, Malachy, as well.
I want my third meeting with Dorothy.
Third meeting with Dorothy
mind.
Parker. I think it's a great place to for the story to have a full
circle. You're an amazing woman, and that epic journey that we made to India to revisit my gold smuggling day. Do you recall when Connor, my son, Connor McCourt, and young Malachy, my other son, was there, yourself, and Chris Room was there? And we stayed at the Taj Mahal in Bombay, as it was then. But do you remember the day we went to the crematorium and the guy got upset because we were trying to surreptitiously get a picture of the body that they were about to burn? We were trying to,
and it was so fascinating to be with it. When you go on a trip with a purpose, like getting Dorothy Parker's ashes or going to follow Malachy McCourt on his old gold smuggling route in India, you get a different world than the touristic avenues that we often visit.
Yeah.
And I remember that very clearly. I also remember, which I hope that you'll tell on the on your show one day, not a gentleman named Callahan of India.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Tell it now.
That's right. His card said that. He was a voice consul, I think. Callahan
yes.
of India. We had dinner at a Kashmir restaurant with him.
Right. And he got young Irish people out of jail for the Irish
yes.
government. I mean, there's so
Callahan
many characters
of
that
India.
You can
I remember his card.
Yeah.
There was somebody called
Clive of
India, wasn't there?
There's a world out there that is
yeah.
open to us.
Oh, my God. I had forgotten all about Callahan of India.
Callahan of India is a great story.
So young
maybe
Maliki,
that's for your next episode.
A young
episode.
Connor had made this film that you got. Now, what's your... You no, you've also done. You've had connections with some very well-known people on radio. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, I have been a filmmaker as well, but I
yes.
started out as a radio and television
else.
Intern in high school. I went to Stuyvesant High School, where a certain McCourt was my English teacher, and I ended up getting internships. As we, you know, because we were in New York, you get to take advantage of New York City. And my first position, unpaid, of course, was screening sex calls for Dr. Ruth Westheimer. That's how I learned about sex. Really, I had no idea what I was screening. I would have to turn to the producers and say, "What is that?" And and I also was an intern for Howard Stern and Don Imus and. I remember you also Soupy Sales, who I know you had a connection to.
That's right, yeah.
And it was really a great way to kind of learn about the world is to be an intern on the Howard Stern show.
I'd say.
I really got over my innocence very quickly.
But so it was, all of those things. So there you are, and you're a terrific writer. And hey, John, how are we doing there on time?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to ask one last question.
Sure,
what is the process of getting a story into the New Yorker? How did you pitch it, and did they gravitate right away? And then Maliki was saying somebody else might have been trying to do it, so you had to get the story in before anybody else?
I had pitched it over. I mean, I've been working on this story for 13 months, and I had the whole story. I had one of the things. I write nonfiction books, and I've done films. And one of the things that you need to always focus on is access. Do you really have access to a story? And if you pitch any kind of outlet, whether it's film or journalism, that's what people are attracted to. So I had Kevin and the three sisters committed to working with me, and I provided that access. She was supposed to we were supposed to get her much earlier in October, and then things just sort of happened, had not out of our control. But basically, you know, access is the key.
Yeah, but then they like the idea of the story. I'm sure they reject, you know, hundreds of stories.
Well, I've written two other articles for them. So I don't,
right.
I'm not a staff writer, but I have written a story about the young woman. I love New York stories. Those are my things. And a good New York story, which, you know, you have here on the show. You have Maliki is telling the best of all times. At all times, it's a good New York story. But I wrote a story for them previously about a young woman named Alice who sued Stuyvesant in the 60s, 1967, to try to gender desegregate New York City public schools.
No, women were allowed in then. Yeah.
Yes, and she won, and I tracked her down. She was sort of a Paul Bunyan character. She never graduated Stuyvesant, and people just talk about her and her influence, and I had tracked her down to rural Maine, where she's a doctor. And that's the kind of thing that gets you in the New Yorker is, can you provide, it's not just telling the story, can you get it inside the story? Can you provide the story? And in this case, when I was reviewing all the facts about the story about Dorothy Parker, I had I could go to Baltimore. I knew that right away. But also, I said, wait a second, Malachi McCourt's are the urn? I know Malachi McCourt. I had pretty good access there as well.
Loved it. You know everybody.
I think you're the black belt in that capacity. I'm getting there though. But say that the thing is also not to just, I mean, for a good New Yorker story, I think that you also have to be a storyteller. It's not just a newspaper story. It has to be literary as well. You have to be able to tell the story. And I've been trying over the years to learn how to work on my craft as well as just gaining access. And I, you know, you listen to the masters, you listen to this show, you know, and you hear Malachi tell a story. I read a lot of the journalism in the New Yorker from the staff writers, and you know, you really have to be open to living, you know, well past when you're a young person. And I keep every day I think about New York and the opportunities that exist, and I take a lot of walks and. I meet so many people, like almost like a beat reporter. I try to go out every day. And I met Kevin Fitzpatrick on this story on a walk. I mean, that's how I had access to the story. You can't really do much investigating if you're just going to try to, you know, Google all day long. You know, you have to get out there. And also, I think it's very important for, you know, it's safe in New York if you put a mask on and you're out in the air. And try to keep away from other people, but you can actually walk around and observe the city. And I think even though there is some sadness to what's going on now, there's also a dynamic energy of recreation and potential that is going on as well.
Doors closing and doors opening. I was in the New Yorker once before.
Were you?
It was a small little. Item. Diane and myself were having dinner with Nora Ephron once, and her then husband, who lived in Prince, she's now in Prince. But Nora said, you know, that Diana was the most beautiful woman in New York. She paid her that compliment because Diana was and is still a marvelous-looking, beautiful person. But so they said in this thing anyway. I forget what the item was about Diana. And she went to Smith, and it was something about, I forget now what it was, but it said that Diana McCourt, she's married to Malachi McCourt, and we put in a pub owner, and New Yorker mistook that, and it said Malachi McCourt, publication owner. Oh. And they didn't know pub meant a saloon. So that was the other
thing. It didn't make it through the fact-checking. I have to say, fact-checking is very hard.
Yeah. So anyway, there was that. But the other thing, you know, that your work on Connors films, the McCourts of New York, McCourts of Limerick, just fantastic. So,
well, we had so much fun, didn't we? I can't express how much fun it was to walk the lanes of Limerick with the McCourt family.
and moving.
And I do remember that we got to show the film at the Cork Film Festival.
And, yeah, that's right, yeah.
And we also went to the Irish Consulate in Dublin.
Yeah, the American Embassy.
Yes, sorry, it was the American Embassy. And
Gene Smith was ambassador, remember?
Right. Although I'm not Irish, as you know, but I always, you know, I love the fact that I kissed the Blarney Stone, and Kevin Fitzpatrick recently said, "Yeah, but you know they piss all over the Blarney Stone." I said, "I didn't know that," so I'm retroactively horrified.
Kiss and piss are not too far apart.
Kiss and piss. but I felt like if I was going to go to Ireland with anyone, I wanted to go with the McCourt family. So that was really
great.
That was one of the highlights of my life, to be honest with you.
Well,
and we got it on
great,
HBO.
Lively companion, and We all had such a good time at the old Taj Mahal Hotel there, which was luxurious as could be, and they treated us well. And we went out and we saw the snake charmers and all the people.
We went to see where the brothels were as well. Thing. Do you remember?
Maliki, I know this is starting to sound like the Algonquin table there at the Algonquin Hotel, but we need to move on. But I'm hoping to have Lori on our new podcast starting on Wednesday, every Wednesday, called Two Macs in a Pod. And Lori, we'd like to have you on. And
I would love that.
As they say, do it all over again, Maliki.
Maliki, I want you to bring back the story of Callahan of India. That's my request.
Okay.
For you.
Yes, indeed.
So that's something that I think you should tell in full on the podcast.
Okay then.
All right. Well, thank you,
Lori Shapiro. The story: a woman of limitless talents, writer, filmmaker, radio. Storyteller, friend, and New Yorker, and she's all things.
Well, I'm
just
thrilled and honored to have been on your show. Thank you, John, and thank you, Maliki.
Thank you very much, Lori. Best of all, and we'll be talking to you.
All right, lots of love.
And you're listening to WBAI in a wonderful a class on storytelling between the two of them. And that's why you should be listening to WBAI. And Maliki McCourt and another storyteller, David Rothenberg, will be doing a fundraiser for WBAI on Sunday, October 11th. It'll be an election special, and we'll be doing it through Zoom. And when we get the website up, you'll go to WBAI.org, pay $20, and then on the day of the event, you'll get an email telling you where to click on and watch Maliki and David speak about the upcoming election. It'll be after the two debates, one presidential and one vice presidential. And Maliki, we're going to expand the format on the podcast because there'll be no time limit on that. But what we wanted to do now, and I know BAI is encouraging producers to take phone calls from our audience. If you want to, if you have a Dorothy Parker story, call in. And the number here is 212-209-2877, and I'll give that again slower. 212, it's still a Manhattan number, 212-209-2877, and we can take phone calls for about 10 minutes and be very short and concise. If you have a Dorothy Parker story, tell it. How are you going to vote in this election, and anything that's coming up. And to talk about and open up the airwaves of WBAI, 50,000-watt station here in the city. And you can reach out. So the number is 212-209-2877. And you know what, Maliki? I think Lori was right. Like, people do listen, particularly to this show, just to hear great stories. And not direct interviews.
I hope it is, anyway. Well, you're a storyteller. And a playwright, and you've done, I mean, your stories about, you put them anyway into an hour and a half on the stage, but you have thousands of hours of stories of your years when you were traversing New York in a taxi cab. Nobody is better equipped to tell these stories, so there you are. So,
and BAI is a great platform. Speaking of that, my play Off the Meter, we're going to be showing it at the Cincinnati Irish Heritage Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. But, of course, I won't be there. And that's going to be in October 23rd, Friday. And we're going to have on Maureen Kennedy in the next couple of weeks to talk about that. And just storytelling. Let's hear a story from our audience at 212-209-2877, and we're down to about 8 minutes. So it's very limiting what we're doing. Remember, at 2 o'clock, the Irish American writers and artists are having a transatlantic salon where artists and writers on both sides of the Atlantic will be performing their art or their party piece on Zoom and on Facebook. So go to Irish American writers and artists, type that in. You'll see the Facebook page come up or the website or however. You'll be able to get it. It shouldn't be that hard. Now, are there any phone calls, Sean? Oh, okay. BAI, you're on the air. Let's keep it short and sweet.
Hi.
Like a donkey's gallop.
Yeah.
How are you?
Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Yeah, good. You're on the air. Come on.
Good. Calling to see if white people can maybe share stories of times that they heard racial slurs for themselves, because I think that a lot of white people don't believe it. They have to, like, you know, take brown skin people's words for it. And then, and if any brown skin people think that, I think that would be comforting for brown skin people to hear. So they're not just beating their heads against the wall trying to convince white people that racism still exists. And then if it's uncomfortable, I would like to hear brown skin people tell us to be quiet and not say that, because I really don't know what they're thinking, because it's just an idea that I thought of.
All right. Listen, that's what BAI is about, is ideas from our listeners. We'll go now to the next caller, WBAI. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you? Hello.
Good. Go ahead. You're on with the great one, Malachy McCourt.
Yes, my name is David Rothenberg. You may recognize
his
voice.
Oh, no.
I, in college, I took a class with a guest lecturer, Mark Conley, who was a member of the Roundtable. He wrote the Green Statute.
Oh, yes, yeah. He was a critic,
and he
wasn't
told
he?
This story that they were all sitting there, him, Wolcott, and Gibbs, and whoever, and George S. Kaufman, and Dorothy Parker. And Dorothy, you know, one of her parents was Jewish and the other wasn't. And somebody made a Jewish joke, and George S. Kaufman stood up and said, "I'm offended, and I'm walking out of this room. And Dorothy, I expect you to walk halfway out."
Very good.
That's right, Dorothy.
I love it. David, do you remember the time I was driving you and Malachy home, and you were in the car, and you were going story for story about who you had met and what was going on? And I think one of the last stories before I dropped you off, with Malachy goes, "Well, that time I picked up Dorothy Parker," and you were like, "Oh no, I can't believe he's trumping my stories." But
I can top him. I met Nathan Leopold from Loeb and Leopold.
Oh yeah,
that's a good one, isn't it?
Well,
it is indeed.
Can you tell us that story? Quickly.
Well, you know, they thought Bobby Franks was not a nice boy, and they killed him. And Dickie Loeb was killed when he was in prison. Nathan got out after many, many years and was a brilliant scholar and went to Cuba doing research. And one night at the performance of the play, Fortune in Men's Eyes, this man introduced me himself to me, and he said, "I would very much like to meet the actors. I've done a lot of time, and I appreciate what's done." And I said, "David Rothenberg, the producer." And he said, "Nathan Leopold, one of the audience members." And I looked, and he said, "You know the name." And I said, "Oh, yes, I do." And I brought him back to introduce him to a couple of the actors.
Well, who don't you know, David?
I don't know myself well enough.
Well, David,
the
thing that you started with the castle and downstairs, the two fakakas talking about the topics, that in October we're going to do it now on Zoom instead of sitting at the castle.
I know, I've heard you say that. After the debate, how am I going to stay awake?
The first debate, September 29th, the first presidential, and then the vice presidential is October 7th. So there'll be plenty to chew on that for the fundraiser on October 11th, a Sunday at 6 p.m.
Oh, it's at 6. Good, I can stay awake. I have to tell you before you go on to the next round, I saw my favorite comic person on television last night. Jean Pirro was on Fox, and she interviewed the president. It was at once hilarious and frightening. She was so obsequious, I thought she was going to perform oral sex on him. But at one point, he said...
Does she follow an open mouth policy?
Does she what?
Follow an open mouth policy.
You naughty person. At one point, he talked about that the leftists are burning down our cities. And I shouted at him, "The whole West Coast is on fire, and you haven't noticed it, you stupid man." All right, go to your next. I want to hear more Dorothy Parker. Thank you for letting me have a moment.
All right, thank you,
old friend.
Thank you, David, for chiming in.
My dear man.
And I, I tell you, there's nothing greater than driving a car and having Malachi McCourt and David Rothenberg in it, trying to upstage each other with stories about celebrities and everything else. And we'll take one last call, and then we'll just review what just happened. BAR, you're on the air.
Hey, it's Russell.
Russell, go ahead. What's happening?
Hey, I hope David Rothenberg sticks to telling stories and not telling people to put masks on, because he doesn't know that he comes off as a fascist. But I'm glad I got to say that. One other thing, John, I'd like to ask you. I read an article about you joining the military in 73. You're the vet of the state, right? And I just wonder, were you like one of those right-wing Irish? What were you thinking joining the military in 73?
What do you think at 18 years old, growing up in the neighborhood where everybody was either drafted or joining, and it was what you did during that? I didn't have a political thought in my head. And if you follow a lot of people in the military, do not have political thoughts. Smedley Butler, who wrote War is a Racket, said that he didn't have for 33 years a political thought in his head until he got out and realized what he had done. And that's when you become politically conscious. And that's what happened with me.
Well, okay, but there were a lot of Irish hippies with long hair running around the Bronx, because I lived there, too, at the time. And I was fighting the police. So, I mean, just when you get down on right-wing Irish, please, you know, remember we all have been there in different places. And what are you going to do? One last thing. Malachi and John, what are you going to do? Trump is going to win. What are you planning to do? And I don't look forward to it. I despise the man. But he's going to win.
I'm organizing prayer meetings for his happy death. Pray
well,
for his
death.
That he has a happy death, and he go and make heaven great again.
Malachi, the most likely thing is if he keeps taking on the military leadership, they'll assassinate him because he's the pro-peace candidate. Thanks a lot, fellas.
Well, Malachi, that was whenever you take phone calls at BAI, especially I like David Rothenberg calling in. We should have had him on as a guest. But Malachi, it's 12:21. I was going to say Sarah Furon, who's with the Irish American Writers and Artists, just sent me a text saying the Parker new condo on West 72nd Street is named for Dorothy Parker. So she continues to make her mark in New York City. And Dorothy lived in the building that stood there. So there
Where's
you have
that,
it. Sarah Theron sent me a text that the Parker, it's a new condo on West 72nd Street, is named after Dorothy Parker.
Oh, really?
Yes. So her name remains in Manhattan. So, Malachi, I just that's why I didn't join in your conversation. You're good friends with her. It was like Judy Collins. I enjoyed it as much as any listener out there, I hope. And, you know, hopefully we'll continue doing that with the new podcast. Remember, we'll be doing a fundraiser with David Rothenberg now next month about the election. And you know what, Malachi, when you were talking about the Banshee there, that it only wailed or screamed for rich people and you didn't hear it in the lane. If you had a Banshee in the lane you grew up in Limerick, it would have been nonstop screaming. With the amount of people that died in the lane.
Oh, that's right.
I mean, you would have just heard nothing but the wail of the Banshee.
My two brothers died, and 11 of my classmates died between the age of 6 and 10. I mean, we were, Frank said, we belonged to the Death of the Month clan. That was, we couldn't wait for people to die because we had, you know, they celebrate, they mourn marriages and celebrate death. We had such good time. We were just hoping more people would die because you got lemonade and cake and you had fun singing banjos and guitars and tin whistles and dances, storytelling. It just went on and on and on.
All right.
But anyway,
well, Malachi,
people did stopped dying, and there it is.
We're going to go out now with Chris Burns, the owner of Rocky Sullivan's and Red Hook. He has a song called...
Aren't we supposed to promo the next program here?
I have to look it up and see that, but it'll be on after us. I should have looked it up, but this is The Gates of Hell, and Sean, you can bring it up behind us, and it's Chris Burns singing a song he wrote about 9/11. And hopefully Rocky Sullivan's will get up and running and we can all get back there and maybe even do some live broadcasts like we used to do out there in Red Hook in Brooklyn. So, Malachi, I'll talk to you later. And just remember, We're going to start podcasting on Wednesday. Go to Malachi's Facebook or Cabtivist, C-A-B-T-I-V-I-S-T, on my Facebook or Twitter account, and we'll update you on what platforms. Everybody's got a platform. We're going to put it on this platform, that platform. We'll just see how it goes. But Malachi, thanks.
And live I've every so day as if it's going to be your last, because one day you'll be right.
The Mets in a distance these days. You seem to hear them everywhere. See your blue stands to attention. The mother walks down the chapel stairs. Through her crying eyes, she watches her Patty as the shoulders carry her son away.
No, 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 no.
Neighbors and friends, they just shake their heads, 'cause they know there's nothing you can say. Folks figure Patty, he's gone up into heaven, 'cause he went missing at the gates of hell. Now the sun's setting down on the Rockaway ground, and when it's coming back, just no one can tell. I met him in the canyon of heroes when Lord Stan finally came down Broadway.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
He was singing and dancing and drinking and laughing, celebrating until the next day. Now there's a whole new canyon of heroes full of people who seem like me and you. No ordinary guy who steps into the tide then tells you it's just what I do. Folks figure Patty, he's gone up into heaven, 'cause he went missing at the gates of hell. Now the sun's setting down
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
My fellow New Yorkers.
My mama, who's a healthcare worker.
Nurses and doctors.
For my father.
For the marginalized communities who don't have access to adequate healthcare.
For my children.
My community.
Essential workers.
Transit workers.
The immunocompromised.
I wear a mask so we can get back to work.
Go to school. Share a meal.
See a movie.
Hug my friends.
Dance together.
Go to the theater.
See our families.
Continue to show support.
Take care of each other.
Save lives.
Stay strong.
I'm Anat Gerstein from Anat Gerstein, Inc. Helping nonprofits is what we do. Nonprofits are working in overdrive to respond to the pandemic. They're running homeless shelters, providing health and mental health services, caring for kids in foster care and homebound seniors and those who are hungry, and much more. They're also delivering educational, entertaining content straight to our homes, and they're doing it all with less. So let's come together to support nonprofits today. Look for the hashtag support nonprofits on social media to learn more.
To my New York City fam, strong, resilient, and proud, now more than ever, it's super important that every New Yorker counts. The COVID-19 pandemic is affecting us all, but it's affecting our Black and brown communities the most. And the only way to get the programs and the funding that we deserve is to fill out the census. It only comes once every 10 years, but the data determines billions of dollars of funding for our hospitals, emergency services, and healthcare programs, which we need now more than ever. It's just 10 questions, and by law, your information cannot be shared. There are no citizenship questions on the census, and you have a right to be counted regardless of your immigration status. So it's up to us to make sure that New York gets the funding it deserves. Go to my2020census.gov and let's be counted. Sending you so much love.